Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far-out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
You know, no one goes to sleep as an adult and wakes up as an adult. No, we go to sleep as children, and we awaken as children. Adulthood is only a disguise that we wear during the daytime. I think that stories are the royal road to sleep, because we listen with the hearing of a child to stories, and we imagine images through the spirit of the child. So even the most elevated member of the intelligentsia or the cognoscenti becomes a child in sleep. The tribal man, the weaver of cloth, the mother, the teacher, they all come to sleep as children and awaken as children, born anew. So I want to fill this time with stories for your sleep ahead and give you the comforter and the peace to rest and rest well all through the night without disturbance or discomfort. So you can rise up in the morning rested and made whole and new again. That's what sleep is, as it's said by the old people, the rest that knits up the raveled sleeve of care. It's the divesting of all the dust and the scales of the day and the return to proper calmness. It's calma y tranquilo, calmness and tranquility, where the heart and the soul and the spirit like to live the very best. So, now, take your ease, and if by chance you drift off into a good sleep while I'm speaking to you, don't be concerned. Tomorrow night, we can begin our time together again where we left off tonight. So if you're lulled to sleep, be assured, I won't be offended. I'll be happy that you're resting and being restored. So now, relax and lie back and let everything that has knit itself together so tightly today fall open. Let your knees fall open and let your jaw drop. Make yourself nice and comfy and your covers soft or heavy, however you like them best. Here, let me tuck that in a little bit for you there. And a pillow just like you like for the back of your neck and your head. And I take a deep breath and relax your shoulders back down to where they belong, not so high up around your ears. Now reach up and wipe away with your hand the furrows on your brow. And just soothe your cheek for a moment. There. That's good. Now, stretch out your toes like a little birdie and then let them go. That's good. And now your hands, flex them and now release them. Let them fall into a peaceful repose. And now, just one more thing. Listen to the sound of my voice. You know, we all go into sleep and into the dream time in different ways, and there are stories about how people leave one reality and enter another, and one of my favorites is from the Narnia Chronicles by C.S. Lewis, in which there are four children who are sent away during World War II out of London to a place of safety out in the country. They're sent to a large house to live with an old professor who's very eccentric and somewhat magical. And one day, as they're playing in the hallway, and they've been told essentially to be seen and not heard because some guests are coming through the great house, they hear the people coming and they quick jump into a giant wardrobe that's there in the hallway. And in this wardrobe, there are fur coats and old woolen leggings and old hats and all manner of things that people store away for the winter. And as they're trying to be quiet so that they won't be detected, all of a sudden they feel a very cold breeze coming through the closet, and they can't figure out where it's coming from. And so they start to pull aside the old fur coats, and they realize there's a light in the back of the closet. But it isn't coming from an electrical fixture, and it isn't coming from a candle. It's coming from something in the back of the closet. And so they move farther and farther back into the wardrobe, and it becomes colder and colder, and they draw aside the last fur coat, and all of a sudden they see that the light is coming from the sky, and in the sky are clouds filled with snow that's slowly falling on a beautiful landscape. And they have found their way into the land of Narnia through the wardrobe. And suddenly, they are there. And one of the most famous lines from that story is, "Narnia, Narnia, awaken, love, think, speak, be divine again." And that's how we move into sleep, too. There's an aperture it comes through, relaxing the body and thinking of matters that are made with love, that are made divine. And there's nothing more magical than an old, old woman who is way past her childbearing years, as she is in the story of the Sleeping Beauty, who wants more than anything with her king to bear a child. But it appears that she has been forbidden this great delight in life. And so she and her king are very, very sad. So sad, in fact, it can barely be expressed. So they had gone to all the different places of the world and seen magicians. They had gone everywhere they could to try the waters and to try new cures and medicines. They had gone on pilgrimage, but everything they tried was to no purpose. And yet, the queen was good and gentle, and the king was great of heart, and they loved each other. And they hadn't married for love the way that sometimes kings and queens did, which was really more to gain property. They had truly married because they recognized each other as souls. So they reigned over a kingdom that was at peace, and all of their people were devoted to them. And in a way, what more could they possibly want? Well, that idea of the child stayed with them and stayed with them. And so many prayers were said in their behalf that one day, miraculously, out of seeming nowhere, the queen felt a movement in her belly, and sure enough, she was pregnant with a child. And oh, the announcement was made to the kingdom that the queen was with child, and the flags waved everywhere, and all the bells in all the churches throughout were sent pealing until the steeples practically rocked back and forth, and people in the streets tossed their hats up in the air and cheered, and soldiers marched bedecked out in their greatest, most shiny medals, and even strangers who met each other in the street, they took each other's hands exclaiming, "Our queen is going to have a child. Our queen. Long live the new little child." And so time went on, the lady and all her ladies in waiting. And every day she sang to the little child who was in her belly, and each day prepared more and more the great ceremony that would take place when this little beautiful darling of theirs was born. And the time came to pass that the queen went into her labor and soon was delivered the most radiant, incandescent child that one could ever imagine. And the king ordered immediately that the ceremonies begin and that a great feast be set and parades take place in the street and that everything that could be covered with gold be covered with gold and everything be covered with a canopy be covered with a canopy and everything that could be set with diamonds and rubies for this great celebration. And so, all the fairies of the kingdom were lined up thinking about how wonderful it would be, this feast, where they would bestow upon this tiny little princess who was so incredibly beautiful, wishes and behests that would serve her for the rest of her life. And yet, it seemed that perhaps there was a problem. They did have 12 plates for 12 fairies, and these 12 plates were made of gold and encrusted with jewels. And they did have 12 knives and 12 spoons to go with the plates. And it seemed that, were there 12 fairies? Or maybe there were 13 in the kingdom. They couldn't quite remember, but maybe, yes, it was 12. And so they sent out invitations to all 12. And at that gala, when all were seated at the great groaning tables that were covered with flowers, covered with gorgeous brocaded cloths, covered and dripping in beautiful laces, and upon which were platters of the finest porcelain from France that carried all manner of game birds steaming and glazed, and apricots from far away, and spices from far away also. And in the midst of all that, the fairies entered the hall, each taking her seat, and each fairy, no matter her age or stature, more beautiful than the next, and one bedecked all in lavender, and another all bedecked in yellow saffron, and another bedecked in the color that roses are in the spring, and another bedecked in the leaf green, the first green that shows in the springtime when winter is over. And on it went, another bedecked as though she had just come from the royal cobalt blue of the heavens, and another bedecked in the red corona of the sun. And when all fairies were seated, and all were eating and enjoying and laughing, and the troubadours were singing, and the musicians were playing, and the soldiers were at attention, and the king and queen at the head of the table were so proud and had the bassinet draped with the finest of laces with the darling, darling child in it. All of a sudden, the great doors of the hall slammed open, and in strode the 13th fairy, and she was dressed in gray, that was the color of dead mosses, and she was dressed in brown, the color of plants that have died long ago, and she was dressed in black, in the colors of things that are not yet seeing the light of day. "Huh," she said, "you thought you would leave me out. Well, I have something for the little princess." And at this point, all the fairies rose up out of their seats and quickly went up to the bassinet, and one by one, with their magic wands, began touching the little princess and whispering a wish over her. "Oh, that you may be beautiful for life. Oh, that your heart may be pure for life. Oh, that you may always be smart and always be wise. And oh, that you may always be skilled with your hands. And oh, that you may always be generous with others and have mercy on others." Almost all the fairies were able to give their wishes, except the very last one, before the 13th fairy strode up to this beautiful, innocent little child. And with her old wand that was made of a crooked piece of willow, she tapped the top of the bassinet and said, "I curse you to die. When you are 16 years old, you will prick your finger on a spindle and you will fall down dead." And with that, the 13th fairy turned in a whirlwind that seemed like it was filled with dead leaves and the muck of swamps and slammed out of the great hall. And the queen and the king and all present were so brokenhearted and saddened and horrified, they began to weep copiously. And "What shall we do? What shall we do? Oh my God, our child has been cursed." But the 12th fairy stepped forward, and she said in a voice that sounded like a nightingale's voice, that this child had been given so much, to be generous, to be loving, to be beautiful, to be able to play music to perfection, to be able to weave without error. She had been given so much. And furthermore, the 12th fairy said, "Even though I cannot change the curse of so powerful a fairy, I can soften it. And so this child, when she is 16 years old, yes, she will prick her finger on a spindle, but she will not die. She will only sleep for 100 years. I assure you, your child shall not die of this disaster. Your child shall live." And so that 13th fairy, all dressed in gray and brown and black, with her hooked nose that met together with her chin almost like a nutcracker, no one knew where she went, only that she was jealous and beside herself for not having been invited to the christening. And the king, in an effort, an anguished effort, to try to avoid the misfortune that this old beast had leveled at this tiny, innocent child, immediately made a proclamation that everywhere, everyone on the pain of death was forbidden to spin thread with a distaff or a spindle, or to as so much have even one little spindle in the house. And that from this time forward, they would have to spin the thread from the wool with their fingers only, and they would have to wind it around their hand. And from there, they would have to somehow put it on the loom. And that was the only way that cloth could be made from that time forward. And the king felt, and the queen too, and the entire kingdom, because this child was so lovely and so waited for, felt this was all right. This was a good compromise. How could she possibly prick her finger on a spindle and fall asleep for 100 years if there are no spindles in the entire kingdom? And so time went on, and the child grew and grew, and if anything, grew more beautiful, more generous, more unruined than ever before, even when she was a tiny babe. And then following about 16 years after that fateful ceremony, the king and queen were traveling away to another wedding of the child of another king and queen. And the young princess was left behind at the castle with all the ladies-in-waiting and the courtiers and the soldiers as well. Except she was a curious child. She was not content simply to sit and sew and to occupy herself with quiet things. And so one day she decided that maybe she would go explore, and off at the edge of the castle grounds was a small building, and at the end of that building was a tower. and the building was very long and narrow, and she thought of it because it seemed like it would have such a long walkway in it that one could run back and forth in, and she loved to run. And so this she did. She entered the building, and sure enough, there was a long run of floor, wide open, unencumbered, and made of shiny, shiny marble. And she ran and ran and slid. And then she ran and ran and slid some more, and was having a gay time. But then she finally came to the place where there was the door to the tower, and she opened it. Oh, this belonged to her family, of course. And inside the door was a staircase, a circular one, that went up and up and up, up into the tower. And so she thought, without a thought, step onto the first stair and see where it went. And no sooner had she taken the first step than the next step seemed a good one to take too. And in this way, she found herself all the way at the top of the tower, where there was an old woman alone who was spinning with her spindle. Now, this old woman had obviously never heard of the king's proclamation against spindles, and the princess had never seen this old crone before, who had a hooked nose that almost met her chin a little bit, like a nutcracker. "Well, what are you doing up here?" asked the princess. "Oh, I am spinning on my spindle, my pretty," said the old crone. "That's very pretty what you do, what you're spinning there. It looks so magical. How do you do that? Could you give it to me so I can do it too?" The old woman looked at her with a look that on the surface seemed like a kindly old woman look, but just in a second, while the child looked down at the spindle, you could see the old woman's eyes glittering like the eyes of a rat. "Oh yes, here, my child, look. Hold the spindle in your hand this way and spin the thread this way." And no sooner had that child taking the spindle into her hand, that when being a little hasty and awkward with it, it ran right into her hand, the palm of her hand, the soft, sweet palm of her hand, and pierced her skin, and the princess fell down in a swoon. And the old woman just smiled and gathered all of her spinning and her spindles together and put them under her apron and went down the stairs and out the hall and out the door. Now, when the king and queen came home and they asked after their child, everyone said, "Oh, I think she's with the stable people." And they went to the stable people, and the stable people said, "Oh, no, I think she's having her hair combed by the ladies-in-waiting." So they went to the ladies-in-waiting and said, "Oh, no, I think maybe she's in the cook's kitchen seeing about dinner." And no matter where they went, they could not find the child. And so finally, they began to search the premises. And as the soldiers and the maids-in-waiting spread out more and more, looking more and more, finally they came to the building at the edge of the castle grounds and entered it. And someone said, "Oh, that old tower, nobody's been up in that tower for years. There's no reason, really, is there, to look there?" But a stalwart soul stepped forward and said, "No, I think we should look everywhere." And so, two by two, they mounted the stairs. And of course, all of them could not fit at the top, but the first was so aghast at what he saw, which was this beautiful child, young, just coming into the fullness of her young womanhood, lying on the floor on her back, their beautiful hair fanned out on the floor, and one of her hands outstretched, and the other one outstretched over her breast, and one of her hands bleeding, and she was as though dead. Oh, the horror that rang out in the kingdom. And so, suddenly, as soon as the word came that the princess had hurt herself. It looked like the prick of a spindle in her hand, and that she had fallen into that horrible sleep that had been prophesied so long ago. All of a sudden, bakers who were at their bakery felt somnolent and began to feel groggy. And women at their looms stopped in mid-pass with their shuttles, put their hands to their heads, just saying to themselves, I'll just rest my eyes for a while. The violin maker stopped his carving and said, I feel that I just need to rest for a while. And all the soldiers in all the battalions began to yawn and say, oh, I don't know what's come over me, but I feel tired. And the king and the queen, where they had sat stunned on their thrones, began to feel more and more tired, and their eyes grew heavier and heavier, until at last all the people of the kingdom, all the animals of the kingdom, the little dogs and the little cats and the little birds, everyone began to fall asleep, more and more asleep. More and more deeply, deeply asleep. And so, the whole kingdom slept. Even the fires in the hearth smoked and went out. And over the years, as the kingdom slept on and on, and the beautiful Sleeping Beauty slept on too, a legend grew up outside the kingdom, reaching far away, even over the oceans, that there was a magical kingdom in a certain place on the earth, where there was a beautiful princess who only true love might awaken her. And so many suitors came from far, far away, looking and trying to see, is there some way to find this princess and to awaken her and the entire kingdom? And as the legend grew over the years, it changed into, it was not only a beautiful princess in a kingdom asleep, it was not only that true love would awaken her, but also that whomsoever might awaken her would then inherit the entire kingdom. And perhaps almost as a response to this, around the kingdom itself grew a great hedge filled with thorns, and it grew up high, 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 a wall higher almost than you could see the top of. And this embraced and protected the kingdom of the sleeping princess. After many years, when suitors came to test the legend that had grown up around the kingdom, they were not as excited once they saw the white bones of other suitors who had tried tangled in the thorny hedge. This hedge was impenetrable, and those who tried to go through were either blinded or prevented entirely, or trapped. And yet, because because of the legend and the promise. More and more suitors came, attempting to see if they could penetrate that gigantic wall around the sleeping princess. One day, a particular prince, some say his name was Floramundo, which means the flower of the world. He came on a great black horse that was so shiny, it was almost like a sun in itself. And when that horse galloped, its horseshoes struck the earth with sparks. And wherever he advanced, toward this great thorny hedge that had grown up around the sleeping princess, and he saw the bodies of those who had tried before him to enter and not been successful, he was taken greatly aback. And so he sat outside the hedge and at night built a fire and thought on these things, thinking, how shall I weigh this, that in here is a great heart who is imprisoned in sleep, and that if only one could love her, truly, she would be awakened. Yet how can one cross such formidable barriers to love someone? And as he thought, he imagined that he could feel her and see her as she truly was. Over and beyond the legend, over and beyond the stories that had risen up, he felt in his heart, in his bones, that he knew her somehow, and that he came not as savior, but as one who loved and loved purely. And night after night he made his encampment outside the great thorny hedge. And one morning, as he awakened, he could hardly believe his eyes. Where he had come through a great woods, picking his way through with his giant horse, almost tree by tree, they were so closely grown together, a wide roadway had opened in the forest. And the bushes and the brambles of the hedge were creaking and swaying as though there were a wind, but there was no wind. And a tearing sound was heard, and it was the thorns and the leaves of the hedge tearing themselves away from one another so that they made way for him to pass through. And he rode up to the castle, through the hedge that now had been sundered open for him. And he saw that none of his men could follow him because the trees and the brambles and the hedge closed again as soon as he had passed through them. But he was a valiant prince, and he had in his heart an image of great love. He felt so strongly that this hedge had not been meant exactly to keep people out, but more so to protect what was within that was so exceedingly precious. And as the prince pranced on his horse past the courtiers, he could see that some of them were stretching a little bit. And as he went past the shops with the bakers and the weavers, he could see fingers and toes twitching a little bit. And the farther he rode, the more he could see people seeming to perhaps be coming to life after a long sleep, but he wasn't quite sure. And then, as he rode, he came to the building that was the edge of the premises of the castle, the building that had the tower attached to it. And he found his way down the long marble hallway, and he found the little door at the bottom of the tower, and he opened it and ascended the stairs. And when he came to the top of the stairs, there lying on the floor, on her back, with one arm outspread and the other over her breast, was the most soulful, most cherishable being he had ever seen in his entire life. And saw how fresh she was, and how newly made in so many ways, and yet, was she asleep? Oh no, look, her eyes, are they not fluttering a little? They are. Her lashes, they're opening. Her eyes, she's looking around. She has a little smile on her lips. What complete magic this is. And he approached with such trembling and such adoration. He fell down on his knees beside her. You see, it wasn't exactly that true love appeared. It was that the enchantment was at an end. The 100 years had passed. And the princess awakened and looked at him with soft eyes. And she said, I have waited a long while. And the prince was charmed with these words and didn't know ever, though time would pass and they would court and be married and have children and become king and queen of this kingdom. He did not know ever if what she meant was she had waited for him so long, or waited so long to be fully awakened. And so the story of the Sleeping Beauty ends. And so the Sleeping Beauty and the prince meet their destinies. Destiny, meaning that which holds promise for goodness, that which will cause me to unfold and to be whole. And in this case, a destiny is coming awake after a long rest. The idea being that rest is the thing that brings new life, that a life that's lived without cease doesn't have enough spaces in it, enough rest periods in it, in order to form new ideas and new loves. And that is one of the meanings of destiny. There's a mother of destiny. She's called Mother Nyx or Mother Night. She has children, and some of her children are called the Destinies. Others of her children are called Hypnos, which means sleep, this being born from Mother Nyx, Mother Night. And also, she gives birth to a whole tribe of dreams and dreamers. And that's one of the parts of sleep that is so interesting. This idea of dreams, of a nightly cinema that, as Freud said, causes us to stay asleep. That dreams preserve sleep. They capture our imagination and our hearts, and sometimes our cojones and our ovarios too. Sometimes they capture our whole physical spirit because they're so compelling. And you can never tell when a dream is going to be a big dream, because sometimes little tiny dreams have big things to say. There's an Aesop fable called The Lion and the Mouse, about a lion who was asleep. And a little mouse started running up and down his spine, back and forth, and back and forth, and back and forth. But soon, this awakened the lion, who put his big paw on the mouse and swatted him down and opened his enormous jaws in order to swallow him. But the little mouse said, "No, oh, please, King of the Beasts, no, forgive me this time. If you do, I'll never forget it. You know, someday maybe I could do you a favor. You never can tell." And the lion was so amused at the idea that this little tiny mouse would be able to help him, the great lion, that he opened up his paw and he let the little mouse go. Quite some time after this, the lion was stalked by safari hunters and was caught in a terrible trap made of the thickest ropes. And the hunters who had caught him desired to carry him alive to the king to give him as a prize to be killed. And so, as they brought their wagon forward to carry the poor lion now trussed up in the rope net, the little mouse just happened to hear his cries and came running, and seeing the terrible, sad spectacle, went up and began gnawing away at the ropes that bound the king of the beasts. And as he gnawed away every now and then, he would say to the lion, "Was I not right? Sometimes the smallest can enhance the largest. Sometimes the smallest can be the very thing to free the largest." And so, the moral of the story in Aesop's fables, all the stories have morals. The moral of the story is that the little may provide access for the large. And that's how dreams are. Even a tiny dream that's very short or seems about something very insignificant, a little flower opens in the dream. Or maybe a little fly flies by but drops a little tiny piece of gold. Never can tell with our dreams, because they are enchantments in a way. Could never tell what they will tell us at nighttime that we could never guess at during the day. Truths, new directions to move in, ways to think, new attitudes. That's what the bounty of dreams brings to us in our sleep. There's another figure in world mythology that has to do with sleep, and that is something that almost every child world over has heard about, and that's the Sandman. The Sandman is an ancient idea that some say rose out of stories from the Persian desert. And the Sandman is the one who, after a long hot day, with everything so warm now in the desert, yet at night, even the sand itself, which is made of tiny little pieces of glass, is cooling off to a habitable temperature. And that Sandman is not exactly a person, but is more a force, a magical force that causes a little breeze to blow through the beautiful spangled canopy of the tent and causes the sides of the tent just to blow back and forth very gently. And that in this breeze is like a beautiful fragrant breath that is refreshing and cooling. That just the tiniest amount of fine sand is lifted to and sparkles in the air as it touches the person resting on their bed. And that this is soothing, and that the person feels compelled to close their eyes and to just listen now to the sounds of the night that take them into the place of sweet, sweet sleep. Two, there's an entire group of stories in the world. They're called sleeping hero legends or stories. And they're about heroes who seem like they have died, but really they are only asleep. And their sole purpose in sleeping is to hold the entire community, the entire village, the entire nation, or an individual psyche together. There's a saying in my family that I have carried for years, which is, sleep well, for God is awake. And in this sense, these heroic souls in the stories, even though they're sleeping, they are somehow awake. They are holding the calm and the renewal and the wholeness of the village. They are not at war. They are not anxious. They are not excited. They are at complete peace. And in Switzerland, there's a story that's told about the three redeemers, that they live in a cave on a cliff, and they're all sleeping, and they hold the continuity of the community together. And they have been sleeping so long that their clothes, like those of Rip Van Winkle, have become ancient, and that the only time that they might awaken is if there's a disturbance in the Paterland, in the fatherland, that they need to help with. But other than that, they will remain asleep. And that human beings are supposed to not create disturbances in the villages or in the fatherland, so that these souls, who are called the redeemers, can be allowed to sleep and continue to hold the peace forever. There's something like that in us too, and something inside of us that knows how to sleep and stay asleep, create peacefulness in us, allow us to stay in a calm state, and to let all the aggravations and annoyances and worries that almost seem like metal bits that are attracted to the magnet of our core during the daytime hours, to let all of those fall away. The stories of the sleeping heroes are really, in a way, stories about not allowing anything to disturb the calm and the peacefulness of the psyche. That it must be a huge catastrophe rather than just the everyday worries or concerns that most people carry with them. The idea is to let the redeemers in the psyche continue to sleep by being peaceful yourself. In the Chronicles of Narnia that we spoke about at the beginning, about the magical wardrobe that opens up into a whole other world, there's also a mouse in that story. His name is Reepicheep. And when I first read C.S. Lewis's Narnia Chronicles and I met Reepicheep, I fell in love with him. He's a gigantic mouse. He's not just a little one. He's a gigantic mouse. And he's so brave that no matter who challenges the unruined heart, he's the stalwart protector. He steps in with his sword and he challenges whoever might try to destroy the beautiful heart of a child. He steps in to protect any heartful child from being predated upon by an assault of or ambushing force. And I think it was that many years ago that I began to love stories about mice in general. Big mice, little mice, all kinds of mice. And I have a very tiny story about a mouse. And this story is known in many different variants worldwide. Sometimes the protagonist is a mouse, usually amongst people who live in the desert and in the plains where there are lots of mice. But sometimes, as in Africa, the protagonist is a little ant. And sometimes in Mesoamerica, it's a little conejito, a little rabbit. But in the United States, this story is called Jumping Mouse. And sometimes it's called the mouse who could leap across the sky. So, once there was a little mouse who was just like every other mouse, except for one thing. Unlike all other mice, this particular mouse could hear a special sound. And she asked the other mice, "Brothers, sisters, do you hear a roaring in your ears? Well, the other mice all said, no, we don't hear anything. And the other mice all agreed that the little mouse maybe had gone completely mad. So no matter how the little mouse tried to distract herself, she continued to hear this great roaring sound. So one day, with her little cane and her little pouch filled with food, she left her village to seek the source of this great sound. And when she told a kindly old raccoon that she was about to go find this great roaring, the raccoon said, "Oh, little mouse, that roaring you hear, I know what that is. Let me take you there." And so the old raccoon took her on paths she had never known before. And the little mouse was a little frightened and thought some of the time of turning back, but the roaring became louder and louder and louder and louder. And eventually, they came to a great river, and this was the huge sound that she alone had been hearing. This great replenishing, cleansing, life-giving river. And it rang out, and it thundered, and it roared, this beautiful river. And the little mouse was awestruck. And some of the creatures of the river swam over and said, "Oh, well, let us tell you something else then. This is the great river, but there's more to life than even this river. If you crouch down and then leap up as hard as you can, you'll see your true home." So, using her little spindly pink legs, the little mouse leapt up as hard as she could, and she suddenly saw, for just a moment, far away, the shining mountains. And her little heart opened with such great love, and she knew that she must go there. "What did you see, little mouse?" asked the creature. "Oh, I saw a sight that will never leave my heart." And so she felt called to make her way into the larger world and set out. After a long, arduous journey, with many predators, because the eagles and the hawks fly over the desert looking just for little mice just like her, she came upon a village where lived an entire enclave of very old mice.
"Welcome," said one of the old mice. "Stay here with us, where it's peaceful and nothing ever happens."
"Ooh," said the little mouse, "can you see the river from here? And can you see the great mountains from here?"
"No, not really. But it's comfortable here. Plenty of seeds. A hidden place. Safe from eagles who want to carry off little mice. Forget your passion. Forget those mountains. Stay here with us. Forget your wild notions."
But the little mouse, who had heard the roaring, had also seen the vision of the mountains, and once these had been seen, she couldn't stay with the old mice, no matter how much they wished to protect her, feed her, and keep her safe. She had to go onward. So she tore herself away and continued her journey. Gathering all of her strength, she ran down the roads in the desert that only mice can see. And the eagles and the hawks overhead made shadows on the land as she ran, and she had to hide many times to keep herself from becoming prey. And so she zigzagged across the vast terrain and had ever so many adventures and close calls until at last, before her stood the shining mountains. It's said, too, that there was a sacred lake in the cleft of the mountains, in which many ideas and hopes and dreams could be seen, that if one were to climb up there, one could even see the roaring river from there as well. And it's said that at different times of night and day, different understandings come to those who climb this mountain and find this lake. And it's said that the little mouse still lives there, a place she considers her true home. And there she lives, as a mouse amongst mice. The one who followed the roaring she heard, while others claimed they heard nothing. Nothing at all. So the little mouse tells her own story about how no one is required to stay in a land where nothing ever changes, and where sorrow always looks backward protectively, and where worry always looks around to see what else might go awry. But she instead chooses to look up, to take the leap, to see a fresh new world. She lifts her eyes up to the new life, to see that sky and the shining mountains and the roar of something greater.
Midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.